me, the demon said. She took a deep breath.
Thank you, master.
The demon nodded.
Hobstool is not pleased with you. You made him work much harder than he intended when he left here 3 days ago. You made him feel inadequate. He is my catcher, my finder and keeper of specimens. He is the one you must rely on for food and drink, so you don't want to upset him.
She looked briefly at Hobstool, who stared back at her with the same inquisitive look he had displayed earlier.
Hobstool uses traps meant to lure his quarry by sounds, sights, and smells that speak to their deepest needs. He is very good at it. I have acquired many specimens as a result of his cleverness and perseverance. You are the latest, and perhaps the most important. But you are still only a specimen. Do you understand?
A specimen. She kept the anger from her face and voice with an effort.
Yes, master.
Good.
The blue eyes glittered.
I am Tile Riverine, Straken Lord of Kral Reach. I rule here. I rule everything from the Dragon Line north to the Quince south, from Hooker Flats west to Brockenthrog Weir east. I rule you. Learn to accept this. I am your master now and forever.
A pause.
Do you understand, Grion Ormsford, once Ard Rhys of the Druids?
She felt her heart sink. She had been hoping desperately that her capture was by chance and not by design, that she would have a chance to gain her freedom after her captor's interest in her waned. But if the demon knew who she was there because it had intended to bring her there, and there was no longer any chance of being set free.
Yes, master,
she managed. It saw the look on her face.
You didn't listen closely enough to what I said earlier, did you? You weren't paying attention.
She cringed in spite of herself, anticipating another rush of pain.
I said that you are inside the world of the Jarkarus, that I brought you here to live. You are here because of me. You are here because I wished it to be so. Think back to your own world, to your visit to the ruins of the Skull Kingdom, where once the Warlock Lord ruled. Think back to the fires that ignited and burned without reason. Think back to the face you saw in those fires when you tried to probe them with your magic.
She knew at once what the demon was telling her. She remembered it all, especially the face that had appeared in the flames coming out of hiding just long enough for her to see its features clearly. It was this face. It was the face of the Straken Lord.
You remember now, don't you? The demon said. Good.
It gestured.
Get on your knees again and bow to me.
She did so, a chill settling through her as she realized how deeply in trouble she was.
Take her, Hobstool,
the Straken Lord ordered. Without bothering to wait, the demon turned away and disappeared up the stairs into the gloom. Hobstool walked over to where she knelt, clipped a fresh chain to a ring on the belt about her waist, and pulled her back to her feet. His eyes studied her for a moment, and then he tugged on the chain to indicate she was to follow. Moving to a heavy iron door concealed under the stairs, Hobstool led her through the opening and down a flight of worn, water-stained stone steps that lay beyond. She followed, docilely, intent on conserving what was left of her strength for a time when she could put it to better use. She was thinking about her predicament. What she had been told by the shade of the Warlock Lord was confirmed. She was inside the Forbidding because the Straken Lord had arranged for a handful of druids who hated her to be swayed into using magic that would put her here. Mostly, she was there because by being there, something else had been set free. The Straken Lord hadn't admitted to it, but she was certain from what the shade of Brona had told her that it was so. Yet it wasn't the Straken Lord that had crossed over into her world in response to the magic that had brought her here, but another demon, one she still knew nothing about. Why hadn't the Straken Lord gone itself? Was the real purpose of the exchange to bring her in, or to send the other demon out? The key to understanding everything was buried in the answer to that question. At the bottom of the stairs, Hobstool turned back along a row of thick wooden doors into which tiny eye slits had been cut. As they passed those slits, she heard sounds emanating from within. Once or twice, blackened digits poked out tentatively, as if sampling her taste on the air she stirred in passing. Torches burned on the walls, creating a thick, smoky haze all along the corridor. Fresh air wafted down stone vents from somewhere above, but not enough to dispel the haze. The flames flickered and sputtered from the pitch-coated heads of the torches, casting her shadow against the stone walls as she passed. Not a place from which many escape, she thought. She looked down at the chains she wore and saw herself as her captors did, an animal on a leash, a creature for display, a pet to amuse them, a curious specimen. In her own eyes, she had been reduced to the lowest level of existence possible, but in the eyes of her captors, she was being treated exactly as she deserved. Men were less than animals in the world of the Jarkarus. Demons and demonkind were at the top of the food chain. Men were little more than an oddity. It was funny, but she had never thought about it before. She had never thought much about the forbidding at all. It was a fact of life, but one so far removed from her day-to-day existence that it barely merited consideration. Until now. Until it was all that mattered. Hobstool stopped before one of the doors, inserted a key into the lock, and opened it. Leading her inside by the chain at her waist, he turned her about, unfastened the chain, and backed out the door. He looked at her again for a moment in that now familiar way, then closed the door and locked it behind him. Grian Ormsford, Ard Rhys of the Druid Order, stared helplessly into the darkness that closed about her. Chapter 11. Rigid with indecision, paralyzed by a sense of helplessness and loss, she stood without moving for a long time. The darkness and solitude of her prison only seemed to emphasize how desperate her circumstances had become. All that was familiar and dependable had been stripped away. Her friends and family, her home and possessions, her entire world. The pain and humiliation she had been forced to suffer at the hands of the Straken Lord had shattered her confidence. Everything she had relied upon to sustain her, even her sense of how things worked, had vanished so completely that it seemed impossible in the wake of its passing to imagine ever getting it back again. Finally, she sank to her knees on the stone floor of the cell and cried. She hadn't cried in a long time, and she wouldn't have cried now if she could have prevented it. Someone might hear, and by hearing, come to understand just how devastated she was. She had spent years learning how to keep any sense of weakness carefully hidden, first as the Ill's Witch, and later as Ard Rhys. Since she had been a tiny child, she had fought to protect herself by hiding her feelings, but that method of self-protection, along with all the others she had been able to rely upon, had vanished. When she was cried out, she rubbed her face against her shoulder to dry her eyes, then stared blankly into the darkness. The slit in the heavy cell door admitted a small amount of light, and after a time, her eyes adjusted to it sufficiently that she was able to see a little of her surroundings. Her cell was approximately 10 square feet, with a single bed covered with straw, a slop bucket, and a drain in the center of the room. There was nothing to eat, and no water to drink. There were no covers for her bed. There was no place other than the bed to sit. She tested the shackles that bound her wrists to the leather belt about her waist, then pulled on the belt as well. Both were tough and unyielding. She rolled her head to get a sense of the thickness of the conjure collar, but without being able to see it or put her hands on it, there was little she could determine. The clasps to both were behind her, where she could neither see nor reach them. Nothing in the cell would reflect their images. She took a deep, steadying breath and exhaled. There was no help anywhere. She got to her feet again and walked to the door, peering through the slit into the corridor beyond. She could see parts of cell doors set into the far wall. Torchlight flickered and cast a mix of shadows and light, but there was no discernible pattern. She could hear faint sounds of movement and talking, but could not make out the sources of either. Smells permeated the air, and none of them was pleasant. What am I going to do? She turned away from the door and stared back into the darkness of her cell. No one who mattered knew where she was. The boy who was coming to rescue her, a boy, had no idea where to look for her. Not that she thought it mattered. A boy wasn't going to make a difference anyway. No one was. Perhaps Weka Dart might have been able to help once upon a time. It was difficult to tell. But he certainly wouldn't be able to help now. The Ulk Bog had warned her against going back, almost as if he had known what would happen. The idea stopped her in mid-thought, a dark and suspicious voice in her subconscious. But she dismissed it quickly. It wasn't as if he had sent her to her doom. She had chosen her own way, and he had chosen his. She had done this to herself. Now any help from him was improbable at best. He was safely away, and would stay so. Questions nagged at her. What was she doing here? Why wasn't she already dead? The Straken Lord had brought her into the Forbidding, and it knew who she was. When she had been the Ill's Witch, she had disposed of her enemies swiftly and without hesitation once they were in her power. A live enemy was always dangerous. So why was the demon keeping her imprisoned? Was there something about the transfer of its ally into the Four Lands in exchange for her that required it to keep her alive? She had not considered the possibility. Maybe the magic that had facilitated the transfer failed if either of them died in the other world. But did they both die in that situation? If so, then the Straken Lord had a vested interest in protecting her until its ally was ready to return. She thought a while about how that return might happen, but it was impossible to figure out without knowing what her counterpart had crossed over to accomplish. Her thoughts drifted to other things, to the turmoil in the Four Lands, to the betrayal by her own druids, and to concerns for her family. It was possible that those enemies who had dispatched her here would try to eliminate Beck as well. Once he found out she was missing, her brother would come looking for her. Her enemies might try to stop him. It wouldn't be the first time that an enemy had come after members of the Olmsford family with that idea in mind. The fact that she was Ard Rhys made the current generation of Olmsfords targets in a way they hadn't been since the time of Shea Olmsford and the Warlock Lord. The longer she spent thinking about the ramifications of what had happened to her, the more determined she became. Her sense of indecision and confusion disappeared. Her fear turned to anger. She began to pull herself together to regain the shattered pieces of her confidence. She no longer accepted her imprisonment as a condition about which she could do nothing. No one had ever imprisoned her and kept her so. She had not gotten so far in the world by giving in to her weaker emotions. She had not survived by giving up in seemingly impossible situations. She tested the strength of the chains and belt again, this time trying to move the belt around her waist so that the buckle was more to the front. She was able to do this by sucking in her breath and jerking her hands all the way to the right. This brought the buckle around to her left side far enough that she could see how it was made. What she saw gave her hope. If she could find something to hook it on, she might be able to pull the leather tongue free of the metal clasp and then loosen it from the catch as well. A search of her cell walls, stone block by stone block, turned up nothing. What protuberances she discovered were too smooth or flat to be useful. She turned her attention to the door. The handle was a smooth metal grip fastened to the door at both ends. No help there. But on making a careful check of the hinges, she found a metal nail head on the lower hasp that had worked free from the wall just far enough to offer a possible hook. She spent the next hour working the leather of the belt tongue where it passed through the buckle around the nail head and pulling it loose inch by inch. All the while, she listened for the sounds of her jailers, for the soft scrape of boots on stone, for the tiniest creak of a door opening. She heard nothing. At the end of the hour, she had freed tongue from buckle and was working on the catch. This was harder because the leather had to be pulled back much farther and with greater force. She struggled with it until she had exhausted herself, then tried again. Somewhere along the way, her strength gave out, and she fell asleep. She woke to the sound of her cell door being opened. Hobstool appeared, blank-faced and empty-eyed, his topknot bobbing gently with his unhurried movements. He carried a tray on which rested a cup of water and some unidentifiable food. He set it by the door, glanced over at her perfunctorily, and went out again without speaking, closing and locking the door behind him. When he was gone, she got to her feet and went over to the food. Because her hands were still chained to her waist, she could not use them to feed herself. She was forced to kneel and eat and drink like an animal. Her rage burned with a white-hot fury, but she made herself consume everything. She would need her strength for what lay ahead, and what lay ahead was freedom. She began work again on the buckle as soon as she was done. She was stronger now, both physically and emotionally, and she stuck with the endeavor long after common sense told her it wasn't working. She did so because she couldn't think of anything better to do or any other plan to try. There were times, she knew from experience, when it was best just to continue on rather than to shift directions. Even when it didn't seem as if you were getting anywhere. Your chances of success weren't always something you could measure accurately. Perseverance in the face of failure counted for something. In the end, she was rewarded. Long hours later, the tongue at last pulled free of the troublesome catch, and the belt fell away from her waist. She held it in her hands, staring at it for a moment in shock, relief and fierce satisfaction surging through her. Her wrists were still bound by its chains, so she could not rid herself of it entirely, but she had a more complete range of motion than before and could lift her hands to her throat and the hated conjure collar. But even as she started to search for the clasp that would open it, she hesitated. It was possible that any effort at trying to take off the collar would trigger a response of the sort that had laid her out earlier. It was also possible that the Straken Lord would be alerted to the fact that she had tampered with it. She could not afford for either to happen until she was safely away from the fortress. But if she left the collar in place, she could not use her magic to protect herself or to aid in making her escape. She would be imposing a severe handicap on herself before she even found a way out of her cell. It was asking a lot. Maybe it was asking too much. Reluctantly, she lowered her hands. She would leave the collar in place for the time being and take her chances. She went back to working on the clasps and chains that bound her wrists to the belt. The iron from which they were made would not be easily bent, and she lacked the tools to do the job in any case. She would have to get out of the cell before she could do anything more. Then, suddenly, she heard the rough scrape of boots outside her door. Immediately, she stepped to one side, fastening her hands about the heavy belt and drawing it close against her chest. A key turned, and the lock released with a soft, snicking sound. Then the door opened, letting in a sudden flood of torchlight. A goblin stepped through, already bending down to retrieve the food tray that Hobstool had left for her. Summoning every last ounce of strength she possessed, she hit it in the face with the belt, and it dropped without a sound. She thought she might have killed it, but she couldn't stop to worry about that. She dragged the goblin to one side, where it wouldn't be seen from the doorway. Seizing the keys it carried, she peered through the door and found the corridor deserted. Gripping the belt firmly, cradling it to her chest once more to mask the rattle of the chains that bound her to it, she went down the hallway in a controlled rush, taking just a moment to close the door behind her. She didn't know how soon her captors would find out she was free, but she didn't think she could count on it taking very long. By the time they did, she had to be outside the walls of the keep if she was to have any chance at all. She reached the stairs and started up. She could hear the soft rustlings of other prisoners below, muted by the heavy wooden doors and thick stone walls. If they saw her, they might cry out. She moved quickly up the stairs, glancing behind as well as ahead, her heart hammering. She reached the landing at the top of the stairs and stopped. She couldn't hear anything. She pressed her ear against the door. Still nothing. There was no help for it. She had to go out. She turned the handle slowly. To her surprise, it gave way, and the latch clicked open. She peered cautiously through the open door to see what lay beyond. She could hardly believe her good fortune. The chamber was empty. She slipped through the door and into the darkened space under the stairway. She was back in the room in which the Straken Lord had confronted her. She glanced around furtively, stepping out far enough to peer up into the darkness of the stairwell into which the demon had ascended. She couldn't see anything. Across the room, the door leading out into the courtyard stood closed. For the first time, she was at a loss as to what to do. If she went out the courtyard door, she would be completely exposed to the denizens of the fortress. Crawl Reach was crawling with demons and goblins, and the chances of her getting through all the surrounding walls and gates to the outside were slim at best. She needed to find another way. A disguise would help, she thought suddenly. She glanced around the room, but there was nothing in sight, no cloaks or armor or anything to conceal who she was. There were no other doors besides the one she had come through and the one leading out. Her choices were clear. She could either take the stairs the Straken Lord had climbed or retrace her steps into the cells. She felt a rising panic and quickly forced it down. She could not make herself go back. She would go up. She began to climb the stairs. She was halfway to the top when the door leading in from the courtyard opened and Hobstool appeared. She froze on the stairs, pressed against the wall, hoping the shadows were sufficiently deep to hide her. Hobstool closed the door and walked to the stairs leading down to the cells. Without glancing up, the catcher went through the doorway and disappeared. In minutes, he would discover that she was gone. Abandoning caution, she raced up the stairs to a dark corridor. She glanced all about for signs of the Straken Lord, but saw nothing. Slipping down the corridor as fast as she could manage while still keeping silent, she reached a rack on which hung a series of black cloaks. She snatched one off and flung it about her, then hurried on. She turned several corners as the corridor wound its way back into the tower, listening all the while for sounds of an alarm. But no alarm was given. Finally, she arrived at a door that opened onto a walkway overlooking the fortress. She could see all of the keep's walls now, 5 concentric rings that enclosed increasingly larger courtyards and broader buildings the farther out she looked. The Peshannon was a hazy gray emptiness that spread away below the bluff, but the fortress itself teemed with life. She saw how completely trapped she was, how far she must go to reach safety, and she despaired. Without her magic to aid her and her hands free of the constricting chains, she could not hope to get away. Even a disguise would not be enough with so many demons and checkpoints to pass through. She had to find a way to even the odds. She glanced around furiously and found what she was looking for. Iron spikes protruded from slots in the battlements, a defense against intruders seeking to climb in. She walked to a cluster set far enough back that they weren't immediately visible to those passing below. Hooking the metal ring that bound the chain to the clasp on her right wrist about the closest spike, she began to twist it against its fastening. The clasp cut into her wrist until she was bleeding, but she continued to apply pressure, gritting her teeth against the pain. At last, the ring snapped apart and the chain and clasp fell away. It took her even less time to free the left wrist, but cost her about the same amount of blood. Hugging her damaged wrists to her chest, letting the blood seep into her clothing, she searched for a way down. Finding nothing, she began to follow the walkway around the tower. There was still no alarm, something she found odd. Perhaps Hobstool hadn't gone to her cell after all. Perhaps the catcher had gone into the cells for something else. She couldn't know. She found a watchtower with a trap door and ladder leading down to the next floor. She climbed down quickly, found another trap door and another ladder, and climbed down that one as well. From the courtyard below, she heard the chatter of the goblins and, from somewhere beyond, the growls and snarls of the demon wolves. Too many enemies lay between her and safety. She hadn't a hope of getting past them all. Her mind raced. Could there be a way underground, tunnels used by the defenders of the keep to move from wall to wall without exposing themselves, just as there was in Tirsis, in her own world? She went down the rest of the way to the floor of the tower. There was nowhere else to go from there except outside or back into the main structure. Wrapping the cloak tightly about her body, she went out the door and into the courtyard. A scattering of goblins was at work, but none of them even bothered to glance over at her. She walked swiftly across the open ground to the nearest door, opened it, and ducked inside. Now she was in a building backed up against the next wall leading out, a storeroom for weapons and armor, and she passed through it to a door on the other side and down the corridor beyond. The corridor twisted and turned through the building as she followed it, and soon she was hopelessly lost. She kept searching for a stairway leading underground, but found none. Her plan of escape was rapidly coming apart. Finally, she found a door that opened into the next courtyard, but there were demon wolves everywhere, prowling the grounds and lying in the shade, dozens of them, huge gray beasts with thick ruffs about their necks and jaws strong enough to snap a spear handle. She glanced at them just long enough to measure the danger before shutting the door. If she had the use of her magic, she wouldn't have worried. Without it, she was no match for them. But she had to get across the courtyard if she was to escape. There wasn't any other way. She opened the door and looked out again, searching for an overhead walkway that would connect the two walls. There wasn't one, or at least one that she could see, nor was there any indication of any other way across. She closed the door again and stood there, trying to think what she could do. In the next instant, the cry of alarm she had been dreading rose from behind her, the thunder of a drum followed by the deep moan of a horn. She didn't mistake it for anything other than what it was, and without another thought, she went out the door and started across the courtyard for the far wall. Instantly, the demon wolves glanced over at her, but she didn't look back at them, keeping her eyes directed straight ahead, trying to act as if she belonged, moving for the closest escape. Just a few minutes were all she needed. Behind her, the warning continued to sound, and now goblins were appearing all along the battlements atop the walls on either side, turning this way and that, searching. She kept moving, trying not to let her panic take control of her, trying to stay calm. She reached the door and grasped the handle to open it. The door was locked. Without pausing, she turned toward the next door down, walking quickly to reach it. But by then, the demon wolves were moving, their suspicions aroused, heads lowered, ruffs standing up like bunched quills, muzzles drawing back to reveal the rows of teeth concealed behind. They advanced on her. The first low growls and snarls came from their throats. Alerted by the sounds, a pair of goblins on the wall behind her stopped to look down into the courtyard. A huge wolf positioned itself directly in front of the door she was trying to reach and turned to face her. She stopped at once, a mistake. The wolf snarled defiantly, sensing that she was either afraid or intimidated. She turned back the other way, but more wolves were closing in, blocking her passage and trapping her. On the walls, other goblins were gathering, staring down at her. She was finished, she knew, unless she used her magic. She reached quickly for the conjure collar to release its clasp, but couldn't find the catch. Frantically, she searched its length for a buckle, for any telltale bit of metal. Nothing. The wolves drew closer, openly menacing now, teeth showing as they stalked her. The closest was no more than 10 yards away. She had no choice. Even with the conjure collar in place, she would have to use her magic to defend herself.
Ah!
She growled at the wolves, making a quick warding gesture that caused them to fall back. She advanced on them as if she meant to punish them and, uncertain as to what she might do, they gave way to her. They were creatures of the Straken Lord, after all, and it had trained them to do its bidding. At some point, punishment had been a part of that training. As fierce as they were, they couldn't completely ignore the responses that had been conditioned in them. Her audacity froze them in place, but only for a moment. It was enough. By then she was back at the first door she had tried, her one chance at escape. She was discovered, and if she couldn't get through the door, her captors would be on her in moments. She quit looking at the walls and the wolves. She ignored the shouts and growls that rose behind her. She quit thinking about anything but the door. Bracing herself, she summoned the magic of the wish song to break free of her prison. But the minute the first strains of the magic rose within her, the conjure caller reacted with blinding pain that seized her throat in a paralyzing grip and froze her vocal cords. The pain was instantaneous, and it rushed through her with relentless purpose, knocking her backwards with its force, sapping her strength, and numbing her mind. Caught in the terrible grip of the caller's magic, she stiffened and screamed soundlessly, unable to help herself in any way. She went down in a heap in the dusty courtyard, tumbling into blackness, lost to everything but the pain and an unmistakable sense of failure that trailed after her through the gathering dark, like a death shroud. Chapter 12. Penn Ohmsford and his companions sailed the Skatalo through the northeast skies over the foothills fronting the Charnel Mountains in search of the village of Taupo Ruff and Kermadec. Finding the former would provide them with a temporary haven, the latter with the guide they needed to reach Stridegate. As Matarin of the Taupo Ruff Rock Trolls, it was within Kermadec's power to give them the aid they required in their search for the Ard Ris. The trolls might be reluctant to help outlanders in most situations, but where it concerned Grian Ohmsford, Kermadec would see that an exception was made. It took them the remainder of the night, but they were sailing at quarter speed, slow enough that they could track movement on the ground and watch the horizon for shadows that didn't belong. Caution was needed, for there were things hunting them besides the druids, and they were all too aware of how desperate their circumstances had become. They were lucky to have escaped the creature that had killed Gar Hatch and his rovers and taken Cinnaminson as prisoner, and they were reasonably sure it was not done tracking them. But even if they avoided that particular monster, there was nothing to say that others hadn't been sent to hunt them as well. At flight from a world in which all the safety nets they had once relied on had been taken down, they could not afford to make a mistake. The boy came back on deck after Cinnaminson was asleep, and, with Kyber's help, took down the bodies of Gar Hatch and his rover cousins, wrapped them in sheeting, and stowed them below decks for burial at a later time. Then he relieved Tagwin at the helm. While he checked the Skatalo's course and speed, he repeated to the dwarf and the elven girl what Cinnaminson had told him. For a while afterwards, no one said much of anything. Tagwin offered to take the wheel back so that Penn could get some sleep, but the boy insisted on staying at the helm through the night, just in case his flying experience might be needed for evasive action. Having gotten Cinnaminson back in one piece, he was not about to chance losing her again to carelessness of his own making. So Kyber and Tagwin slept instead, and Penn was still at the helm when dawn broke in a slow brightening of the skies through gaps in a wall of massive peaks that rose before them. The stars and moon had gone, and the darkness was receding west, the new day a promise of the possibility, at least, of something better and safer. Penn's eyes were gritty and blurred by then, and his need for sleep was acute. When Tagwin appeared with a simple breakfast of bread and cheese he had scavenged from the supply room below, the boy was so grateful he could barely speak. He ate ravenously and, after looking in on Cinnaminson to be sure she was all right, went off to bed. He awoke near midday when Kyber shook his shoulder and told him to come on deck. "I think we found Taupo Ruff," she announced with a grin. "Come see." He rose and went topside, finding Cinnaminson there as well, come awake a few hours earlier to join the elven girl and the dwarf in the pilot box. Looking out over the ship's bow to the landscape below, he saw a cluster of dark stone buildings and walls stacked in close proximity to one another on a low bluff and backed up against a cliff face that was riddled with caves connected by ladders and walkways. His initial impression was of a warren that probably ran as deep into the mountain as it extended out from it. Trolls of all sizes and shapes were moving about, but there seemed to be little interest in the Skatalo's approach. No defensive maneuvers were being undertaken, and from what Penn could make out, there were few guards of any sort. The boy knew almost nothing about trolls. He had seen a few in his life. Some of them had come to Patch Run to employ his parents. But his travels had not taken him into the deep Northland, where the tribes made their homes, and trolls by and large did not venture south of their traditional homelands. He thought that he had heard his mother speak in the troll tongue once or twice, but he couldn't be sure. "Can we communicate with them?" he asked impulsively.
"I can speak a little of their language," Tagwin ventured.
He shrugged.
"It won't matter once we find Kermadec."
If this is Taupo Ruff, and if Kermadec is here, Penn thought without saying so. As he brought the ship slowly around toward the village, he called to memory what little he knew about the inhabitants. Trolls were nomadic by tradition, and frequently resettled themselves when their safety was compromised, or their dissatisfaction with local conditions grew sufficiently strong. But because they were tribal as well, they established territorial boundaries within the regions they traveled, and one tribe would never think of invading another's domain. Of such trespasses had the worst of the troll wars been born, wars that had died out years ago in the wake of the establishment of the first druid council. Gallifile and his druids had made it their first priority to stabilize relations within the races. They had accomplished that by setting themselves up as arbitrators and peacekeepers, developing a reputation for being fair-minded and non-judgmental. The trolls, who were the most fierce and warlike of the races in those days, had accepted the druids as mediators with surprising enthusiasm, anxious perhaps to find a way to put an end to the tribal bloodshed that had plagued them for so long. Trolls were creatures of habit, Penn's father had told him once. They embraced order and obedience within the tribal structure as good and necessary, and self-discipline was the highest quality to which a troll could aspire. There was more than one species of troll living in the Northland, but by far the most numerous of the tribes were rock trolls. Physically larger and historically more warlike than the other tribes, they were found principally in the Charnels and the Kensrow, preferring mountainous terrain with caves and tunnels rather than open encampments as safe holds. The forest and river trolls were smaller in size and numbers, and they were not nomadic in the way of rock trolls. The differences went on from there, but Penn couldn't remember them all. What he mostly remembered was that rock trolls reputedly made the finest weapons and armor in the four lands, and they knew how to use both when provoked. "Someone's noticed us now," Kyber announced, nodding toward a handful of troll warriors walking out to meet them. Penn let the airship settle to the earth in an open space at one end of the plateau, well away from the village and its fortifications. Whatever happened, he did not want to give an impression of hostility. He shut down the thrusters, closed off the parse tubes, walked to the railing, tossed out the rope ladder, and climbed down to set the anchors. The others followed, with Tagwin in the lead, looking bluff and officious. The trolls came up to them, huge and forbidding giants, their bark-like skin looking like armor beneath their clothing, their strange, flat-featured faces devoid of expression, but their eyes sharp and watchful. One of them spoke to Tagwin in deep, guttural tones, a query of some sort, Penn thought. The dwarf stared at the speaker blankly, then glanced hurriedly at Penn. The boy shook his head. "You're the one who says he speaks the language. Say something back to him." Tagwin gave it a valiant try, but it came out sounding a little as if his last meal hadn't quite agreed with him. The trolls looked at one another in confusion. "Just use whatever troll speak you possess and ask him if Kermadec is here," snapped Kyber, impatient with the whole business. "Ask if this is Taupo Ruff." The dwarf did so, or at least appeared to do so. Penn caught the words Kermadec and Taupo Ruff amid all the garble, and the reception committee seemed to do the same. One of them nodded, beckoned for them to follow, and turned back toward the village. The other three fell into place about them like a stockade. "I hope we haven't made another mistake," Kyber muttered to Penn as she glanced about uneasily. Penn took Cinnaminson's hand and held it firmly in his own. The rover girl did not pull away, but moved closer to him.
"It doesn't look it, but this village is heavily defended," she whispered to him. "We can't see most of it. Most of it is hidden inside the mountains. I can feel the heat of furnaces and forges. I can feel movement in the earth radiating out from the rock."
The boy exhaled sharply. "Are these trolls enemies?" he asked. "Are we in danger?" She shook her head.
"I can't tell, but they are prepared to do battle with something, and whatever it is, they mean to see it destroyed if it tries to attack them."
Penn nodded. "If we have to flee, I will stay right beside you." She said nothing in reply, but squeezed his hand tightly. They moved through the heavy stone walls that formed the outer fortifications into the village itself. Trolls turned to look at them, trolls of all sizes and shapes, but their gazes were brief and didn't linger. A few young trolls, barely 5 feet tall yet, though big when compared to Tagwin, who was not much more than that himself, fell into step beside them, casting interested glances at the outlanders. No one tried to speak to them, and no one did anything threatening. Penn studied the buildings as he walked, comparing them with those of Southland villages. The biggest difference was in the construction, which was almost entirely of rock and suggested that every building provided its own defense. Each unit had heavy iron-bound wooden doors and shutters, and weapons ports had been cut into the walls for use by the defenders. It had taken a lot of work to build the homes, and it seemed in direct contradiction to the nomadic tradition of the people who occupied them.
"We didn't do anything to protect the airship," Kyber whispered to him suddenly, a frown crossing her dark features.
Penn nodded.
"I know, but what could we have done?" sent Tagwin on ahead alone until we knew what to expect, she replied. We aren't being very smart about this.
Penn didn't respond.
I don't sense any hostility, Cinnaminson said quietly. We aren't threatened.
Kyber rolled her eyes, as if to suggest that a blind rover girl might not be the best judge, but didn't pursue the matter. They had just rounded the corner of a massive building that looked to be a storehouse rather than a home when a huge rock troll appeared in front of them, arms outstretched and voice booming out in familiar dwarfish.
Bristlebeard, you've found your way, the troll shouted, reaching down to pick up Tagwin and hold him out at arm's length as if he were no more than a toy. It's good to see you safe and sound, little man.
Tagwin was incensed.
Put me down at once, Kermadec. What are you thinking? A little decorum would be appreciated.
The big troll set him down at once, drawing back.
Oh, well then, sorry to have distressed you. I was only expressing my great joy at finding you in good health. It hasn't been a good time at Paranor, Tagwin.
This does not come as news to me, the dwarf snapped.
He cleared his throat officiously.
Here, let me introduce the others.
He did so, giving a quick explanation of who his companions were, without yet getting into why they had all come together. Kermadec nodded to each at the mention of their names, his flat features somehow reflecting the pleasure he took in meeting them. There was an exuberance and expansiveness to the big man that transcended what Penn had heard of the troll character, and he found himself liking their host right away.
Penderin,
Kermadec said, taking the boy's hand in his own. It was like shaking hands with a rough piece of wood.
Your aunt and I are great friends, friends from as far back as the coming together of the Druid Order, and I regret what has happened deeply. Your presence indicates that you intend to join me in doing something about it. You are most welcome.
He turned to Tagwin.
Now, you must tell me all about what has happened since our parting at Paranor, and I will do the same. Come with me to my home, and we will have something to eat and drink while we talk. Is that an airship you flew in on, Bristlebeard? I thought you hated airships.
Dismissing the trolls who had guided them in from the Skatalo, Kermadec led them on through the village until they were almost to the cliff face against which it was backed. At that distance, Penn could see clearly the sophisticated network of walkways and ladders connecting the village to the caves and tunnels that riddled the cliff. He could also hear, for the first time, the sounds of hammers striking anvils and smell the fires of the furnaces that serviced them. What was odd was that he couldn't see any smoke or ash. He asked Kermadec about that, and the troll pointed skyward.
The residue of the furnace fires goes into a vent system that carries it out the other side of the near peaks. It helps keep the air we breathe out here in the village clean. It also helps disguise what we do. You can't be sure where we keep the furnaces until you get this close. The furnaces are our lifeblood. Without the furnaces, we can't make the weapons and metal tools we trade to the other races for the goods we need. Without the furnaces, we would revert to what we once were, raiders, and worse. If anything happens to them, we are left without a way to make a living.
What do you do with the furnaces when you move to another site? The boy pressed. You don't take them with you, do you?
Kermadec laughed.
That would be a neat trick, young Penderin. The furnaces are built right into the rock of the mountain. No, we shut them down, cool them off, and conceal them. We close off the entrances that lead to them as well, and we set traps to discourage the uninvited. As long as I can remember, no one has ever bothered our furnaces.
And there are those who would, I can promise you,
Tagwin declared grimly.
Kermadec clapped him on the shoulder so hard he almost knocked him off his feet.
If they could, Bristlebeard. If they could.
So you have other furnaces in other places? Penn pressed.
Half a dozen that have been constructed over the years. More if you count the ones we have abandoned as unsafe. We are a mobile people, but our villages are well established. We simply move back and forth among them,
choosing the one that seems most advantageous with each migration. Just now, we are concerned about uninvited guests, and so have chosen this village, with its superior defensive positioning.
Kyber glanced about. You don't look all that ready to go to ground if you are attacked. No guards, no sign of anything out of the ordinary. We just sailed right in on the Skatalo.
Only because we saw you coming from 5 miles off and identified your sloop as harmless.
The dark eyes swept back to her and away again.
Don't mistake what you see, Kyber Elysadil. We keep close watch in all directions. We won't be easily surprised. If we are threatened, we can disappear into the caves behind the village in a matter of minutes, much quicker than an enemy can reach them. Once inside, we can survive for months on the provisions stored, or we can escape through any number of back doors, and there are extensive fortifications inside the caves as well, in case an attack is pressed. Believe me, things are not entirely as they seem.
Which was in keeping with most of what they had encountered on their journey to reach Taupo Ruff, so his guests decided to take him at his word. A few minutes later, they were settled inside the big troll's home, a sprawling affair occupied by his brothers, sisters, parents, and grandparents, as well as a child or two somehow connected with the rest. Kermadec explained, on completing introductions, that trolls tended to house together in families, often living that way the whole of their lives. The house his family occupied had once belonged to another family, but that family had lost enough members over the years that they no longer needed anything quite so large. Since Kermadec's family had grown, they were offered the other family's home in exchange for their smaller one. It was an odd approach to determining living conditions, but one that the trolls seemed quite used to. Homes didn't seem to belong to any one person or family, but to the entire community. Penn thought that perhaps because rock trolls moved so often, they weren't quite so attached to their possessions, homes included, and were therefore able to share more freely. Still, he was curious about all those people living together under one roof, and after being served a cold drink of black tea and herbs, he asked what determined if any member of the family moved away. Or didn't they? This produced an even odder and more complicated explanation of the troll lifestyle. Trolls, Kermadec offered, did not maintain family units in the same way as the other races. Trolls started out life as children in one family, but often ended up as children or even adults in another. When sickness or death rendered parents unable to raise their children, other parents stepped in. When a child or adult grew dissatisfied with a family situation, he or she could petition to move elsewhere, and frequently the move was allowed. It was thought better to accommodate that individual and try to ease the source of dissatisfaction than to allow the problem to fester. The move didn't happen until a thorough effort had been made to resolve the conflict. Moreover, troll parents did not regard their children as the exclusive property of the family and were not possessive of the responsibility for raising them. The care, nurturing, teaching, and disciplining of children was the responsibility of the entire village, and everyone was involved in the rearing process. Successes and failures were always shared. Decisions and pronouncements were never left to one person. A troll child started out life as the result of the union of two people, but reached adulthood as the result of the efforts of many.
Well, that's enough for now about the social structure of rock trolls, young Pendaren,
Kermadec declared, seating himself across from the boy and the others.
Tell me everything that's happened. Bristlebeard, you begin. Right from the time I left you at Paranor. Tell it all.
So they did. Each of them speaking in turn, each of them adding a piece to the larger puzzle.
Tagwin told of coming to find Penn's parents at Patch Run and finding only Penn. The boy related the details of their escape from Tarak Molt, the subsequent encounter with the King of the Silver River, and the task he had been given, to travel to the ruins of the ancient city of Stridegate and the forest island of the Tanaquil. Tagwin then picked up the story once more to tell of their decision to seek help at Embrun from Arryn Elysadil,
Much of it was difficult, especially Kyber's recitation of the events surrounding her uncle's death in the slags. When it came Cinnaminson's turn to speak of the creature that had killed her father and her cousins aboard the Skatalo, she was forced to stop and compose herself several times. But both Elf and Rover made it through their tales, through the dark and terrible hurt they'd experienced, to emerge, Penn thought, a little stronger than when they had started out. Kermadec listened carefully and, when they had finished, shook his head in a mix of disgust and disbelief.
I knew our Grian had placed too much faith in her ability to keep those druid sorceresses from reverting to kind, Tagwin. Even an Ard Rhys can do only so much with black hearts and foul schemes.
He sighed.
But losing Arryn Elysidil, I never thought I would live to see that. I never thought anything could happen to him as much as he had survived already. He was the best of them, Kyber, your uncle. The best of them all.
She nodded in acknowledgement of the kindness of his words. I appreciate hearing that.
And Cinnaminson, he turned to the Rover girl. I am sorry for the death of your father, whatever the circumstances that brought it about. Your father is an irreplaceable loss. You have shown great courage and presence of mind in surviving the madness that consumed him. I will send my trolls to see that he and his cousins are given burial.
He leaned forward.
Now then, you have told me your tale. Let me tell you mine. Maybe we can make some sense of this business once I do.
After leaving Tagwin at the Druid's Keep, Kermadec had traveled north on foot out of Paranor and across the Strelaheim to the ruins of the Kingdom of the Warlock Lord. He did not want to do this, but he had no better idea of where to begin his search for Grian Olmsford. Days earlier, he had accompanied the Ard Rhys to investigate rumors of apparitions and strange fires within those ruins and had encountered an impossibly dark and evil presence. The Matarin felt certain that there was a connection between that presence and the disappearance of the Ard Rhys, and he was hopeful that by taking a closer look at the site where the presence had revealed itself, he might discover something useful. It was a long shot at best, and as Kermadec had made clear to Tagwin, the troll people did not go into the Skull Kingdom for any but the best of reasons. Kermadec was brave, and there were few dangers that could turn him aside, but that was one of them. Rock trolls had an inbred fear and distrust of the land where the warlock lord had ruled and been destroyed. Rock trolls, in that time and place, had served the warlock lord, slaves and soldiers to help in the conquest and subjugation of the four lands. It had taken many years for the trolls to recover from those monstrous times, years for them to be accepted again by the other races. Grian Olmsford had done much to make that possible. If a journey to the Forbidden Land was what it would take to help her in turn, then so be it. Nevertheless, he had determined that he would not go back there alone. So he traveled first to a gnome village situated below the River Lethe on the western borders of the Knife Edge, seeking a man he believed would know better how to protect against the danger he expected to encounter in the ruins. The man's name was Achen Wool, and he was a gnome shaman of some repute in the tribe to which he belonged. He was old, perhaps 90, and he had been a shaman the whole of his life, living with the Worst, a tribe that migrated across the Strelaheim between the Kensrow and the Charnels. Kermadec had met Achen Wool 20 years before on an outing that had brought a company of his trolls in contact with the Worst, while the latter were under attack from mutants. In most circumstances, rock trolls would have nothing to do with gnomes because the two races were traditionally at odds over territorial rights and migratory routes. But the trolls hated mutants worse than anything. Voiceless, soulless remnants of the warlock lord's dark magic, the mutants survived in the Knife Edge in much the same way as the weirbeasts did within Olden Moor, by preying on the gnomes who worshipped them as sacred spirits. So Kermadec had broken the unwritten rule that forbids trolls from interfering with the lives of gnomes, and his company had come to the aid of those unfortunates who were being butchered by the mutants because they had ventured too close to the monsters in a misguided effort to appease them. Among those rescued were women and children, and the shaman, Achenwol, who accepted the gift of his life from the trolls with a promise that someday he would repay the favor. Kermadec had not claimed that promise before. He chose to claim it now. With Achenwol in tow, he journeyed back through the Knife Edge, carefully avoiding the caves of the mutants, until he was back within the ruins of the Skull Kingdom at the site where Grian Olmsford and he had encountered the strange fires and the apparition. Without revealing the involvement of the Ard Ris, he recounted to Wool the events of his earlier visit, suggesting that the apparition had appeared unbidden and that he was searching for its source. Together, they combed the ground surrounding the cold and blackened fire pit that had given birth to the presence, looking for something that would reveal its source. They found nothing. As nightfall approached, Kermadec suggested they leave and come back in the morning, but Achenwol insisted that they stay. Once it was dark, the shaman would try to summon the apparition himself. Kermadec felt that was a dangerous undertaking and that he should put a stop to it, but he was desperate to discover what had become of the Ard Ris, and the shaman was still the only chance he had to unlock the secret. Achenwol was a skilled conjurer and an experienced shaman. He would not be careless in his efforts. He might accomplish what Kermadec could not, find a link between the apparition and the Ard Ris. Ignoring his instincts, which were screaming at him to get out of there, Kermadec convinced himself that the risk was necessary. So they sat together in the growing dark, the old gnome and the troll Matarin, watching and waiting for something to happen. Darkness fell, and nothing did. Midnight came and went. The mountains were still and deep and seemingly empty of life. Finally, with the moon down and the stars layered across the black firmament like scattered grains of brilliant white sand, the shaman rose from his place in the rocks, motioning for Kermadec to remain where he was. He moved forward to where the fires had appeared last.
I had a bad feeling about it right away, but I kept still, the big troll told Penn and his companions. I could still remember how that apparition made me feel. How dark and terrible was its visage, and I thought it would be better if we didn't see it again, ever. But the little man was determined. He had courage. So I let him go. I was thinking that this was the way I would reach your aunt, Penn. I was thinking that this was how I would discover where she was.
He shook his head at the memory.
Achenwol brought up the fires right away, as if all he had to do was reach down to wherever they were hidden and summon them up. The fires flared and hissed right in front of him, bright flames burning with such intensity I could feel the heat from where I was sitting a dozen yards away. I heard the shaman muttering, saw the movement of his hands. I peered through the darkness to the flames, watching. This is what I've been hoping for, I kept thinking. I'm going to find her after all. But then, all of a sudden, the flames just exploded. It was as if they found a fresh source of fuel. Though there wasn't anything but the darkness for them to feed on, they shot upward 100 feet, maybe more, all brilliant orange and yellow-tipped, crackling and hissing. It surprised me so, I almost fell over. But here's the odd thing. There wasn't any new heat. The fire burned with the same intensity, at the same temperature as before. Like magic.
He exhaled softly.
Something reached out of the flames and wrapped itself about the old man. I don't know what it was. A part of the fire itself, I guess. It snatched him up, and it pulled him in. He was gone in an instant, so fast I barely saw it happen. He never made a sound. He just disappeared, The flames consumed him. There was nothing left. Then I saw that face. The one the Ard Rhys and I had seen days earlier. I saw it in the fire, just for an instant. It was a dark and twisted thing, its eyes like a cat's, only blue and freezing cold. Those eyes were searching the darkness beyond the fire, hunting. I stumbled over myself trying to hide from them. I flattened myself against the rocks the best way I could. I never thought to do anything else. It was instinct that drove me, that warned me that if the eyes found me, I would go the way of the old man. So I hid. The face was there, the eyes searching for a moment more. And then, both were gone. A second later, the flames were gone too, collapsed into a black smear of ash, burned into the stone of the pit. The heat died with the flames, and the night turned still and empty again. I stayed where I was for a few minutes more, then came out to look around. In the starlight, I could see what was left. Nothing. Nothing at all. His voice trailed off, and his gaze dropped to where his big hands knotted in his lap. In the silence, Penn could hear himself breathe.
It was a trap, Kermadec said quietly.
It was a trap set to snare anyone who dared to search for the Ard Rhys. It got the old man. It could have gotten me just as easily. I came back to Taupo Ruff alone. I will never go back to that place again.
Does this mean you won't help us? Penn asked him, impatient to know where Kermadec stood on the matter.
Did I say that? The rock troll exclaimed. Did I say I wouldn't help you find this tree so that you can fashion your dark wand? Did I say I wouldn't help you reach the Ard Rhys and bring her out of the forbidding? Shades, young Penderin! Of course I will help you! If I have to carry you to Stridegate and back again on my own shoulders, I will do so. All the rock trolls of Taupo Ruff will carry you, if that's what's needed. We owe more than a little to your aunt for bringing us back into the mainstream of the Four Lands. She gave us trust and recognition when no other would, and we won't let that gift be for nothing. Whatever those black hearts at Paranor might pretend, we are still the Ard Rhys protectors, and we will see her safe again, or know the reason why.
He stood up suddenly.
But I need to think on this a bit. The country into which you must go is dangerous. Not that the rest of the Four Lands isn't, so long as Shadea Aru is acting, Ard Rhys. But it's treacherous country all on its own, made more so by the presence of Urdas and some other things that have no name. We must make certain we keep you safe in your travels, those of you who decide to go.
He glanced sideways at Cinnaminson.
But there will be time for that later. For now, eat and rest. I'll set sentries to keep watch for the dark things tracking you, and I'll start the process of outfitting an expedition. But how will we travel? It's safest if we go on foot. Airships have difficulty getting through these mountains. The winds are unpredictable. They can send airships into the rocks as if they were pesky insects. But time is important, too, and travel afoot is slow.
He shook his head worriedly and went toward the door.
I'll think it through. Just ask if you need something. There's plenty who speak the dwarf tongue here. We'll celebrate your safe arrival tonight.
Then he was out the door and gone. I don't want you to leave me behind, Penn, Cinnaminson told him as soon as they were alone. They had eaten, and Kyber and Tagwin had gone out to look around the village. The boy and the girl sat together in Kermadec's home, the other members of the big troll's extended family coming and going silently about them, engaged in tasks of their own. It was after midday, and Penn was feeling the need to sleep again, but he couldn't sleep until this conversation was finished. I can't be responsible for putting you in any further danger, he replied, deliberately, keeping his voice down so as not to attract attention. Her face was anguished. The thing that killed Papa still tracks us. It didn't die back there in that meadow. It will come after us. If it finds me, it will use me to find you, just like before. How can that be any less dangerous than what you might find where you are going? You will be safe here, he insisted. Kermadec's people are too well armed, and this village too well fortified for anything to get to you. Even that thing we escaped. Besides, you don't know that it's still coming. She kept her empty eyes fixed on the sound of his voice, as if she could actually see him speaking. Yes, I do. It's coming. He rose and walked to the open doorway of the room, stood there thinking, then came back to sit beside her. I'll have you sent home aboard the Skatalo. Someone in this village must know how to fly an airship. They will take you back into the Westland, to wherever you need to go. Kermadec will arrange it. I'll ask him to see that you are protected. She stared at him for a long time, as if perhaps she hadn't heard right, then shook her head slowly. Do you wish to be rid of me, Pen? Do you no longer need me in your life? I thought you said you cared about me. No, don't speak. Listen to me. You cannot send me home. I don't have a home to go back to. My home was with Papa aboard the Skatalo. There isn't anyone else who matters now. Only you. My home is with you. He looked down at his hands. It's too dangerous. She reached over and touched his cheek. I know you are afraid for me. But you don't need to be. I'm blind, but I'm not helpless. You've seen that for yourself. You don't have to make me your responsibility. You only have to let me come with you. If I let you come with me, I make you my responsibility, whether I like it or not, he snapped. Can't you see that? What I see is that I can be of use to you. Her voice was desperate, almost pleading. You need me. I can guide you where you are going in the same way I guided you across the Lazarene and through the slags. No one else can see in the dark the way I can. No one else has my sight. I can help, Pendaren. Please, don't leave me behind. Of course you're coming, Kyber Elysidil said quietly. The elven girl was standing in the doorway, watching them. They had been so wrapped up in their conversation they hadn't heard her come back in. Kyber, you're not helping. Don't lecture me, Pen. We don't need lectures, she and I. We share something that puts us in a better position to see what is needed here than you do. We've both lost someone important to us on this journey. We've lost a part of our family, and therefore, a part of ourselves. We could be diminished by this, but we won't let that happen, will we, Cinnaminson? We will use it to make us stronger. Neither of us would consider for a moment being left behind. If you think that I am better equipped to handle what lies ahead because I have the use of elf stones, or that Cinnaminson is less able because her talent lies only in her mind sight, then you need to think again. She was so vehement that Penn was left speechless. Of all the people he had expected to agree with him on the matter, Kyber was at the top of the list. Get out of here, Penn, the elf girl ordered, gesturing toward the door. Go find something to do. Cinnaminson and I need to talk. While we do, you think about what I just said. You think about whether what you are asking of her is reasonable or not. You think about everything that's happened while you're at it. Use your brain, if you can find a way to it through all your wrong-headed opinions. She was angry. Her face flushed, and her gestures curt and threatening. Penn stood up slowly and glanced down at Cinnaminson. She was staring straight ahead. Tears were leaking from the corners of her eyes, streaking her smooth face. He started to say something, then stopped himself. As he left the room, he felt Kyber Elysidil glaring at him. He walked through the house, past the surreptitious glances of the trolls, his gaze directed straight ahead. When he was outside again, he stopped and stared into space, wondering exactly what had just happened. Chapter 13. Darkness had fallen over Paranor, deep and smothering, and the Druid's Keep was wrapped in silence.
Within the fortress halls, the druids came and went like wraiths, cloaked in black and hooded. They passed down halls that echoed softly with the scrape of slippers and the rustle of robes. Some cradled books and loose-leaf writings in their arms. Some carried materials for the tasks they had been given in the cause of the druid order. One carried nothing but a second cloak, neatly folded over one arm, so preoccupied that not a glance was spared for those it passed. Beck Ohmsford looked up as the cloaked figure entered the room, and it took him a moment to realize it wasn't a druid at all, but his wife. Rue Meridian came over to where he lay looking hot and feverish beneath his covers and laid the cloak at his feet. She bent close to keep her voice a whisper.
I hope you don't feel as bad as you look.
He smiled. He was hot and sticky, and beads of sweat dotted his forehead. I look terrible, don't I? That root you gave me really works. Trant Rowan was here earlier to see how I was doing. I told him the fever had come back worse than before and was highly contagious. He was in and out of the room in seconds. No one has been back since. You found the robes, I see. No one saw you? She sat beside him, leaned over, and kissed his forehead.
Have a little faith, Beck. I am resourceful enough when it's needed. I just asked for them. I told the druid I stopped that we would feel more comfortable being here if we were dressed as they were. Besides, it isn't me they're interested in. They watch me from around corners and through cracks and doors, but they don't pay close attention. You are the one who matters. So long as they think you intend to do what you were brought here to do, we won't have any trouble.
Beck nodded.
After tonight, we'll be more trouble than they thought possible. Hand me a cold cloth and towel.
She rose and did what he had asked. He sat up in the bed and began wiping himself down, washing away the sweat and grit, then drying off. The room was streaked with shadows, and the candles he had lit at sunset did little to chase the gloom. All the better, he thought, for what they had in mind.
Did you have a chance to check out Swiftsure?
She sat next to him again, keeping her voice low. There was still reason to worry that they were being listened to.
They cut loose the aft radian draws and locked down the thruster lever. I didn't see anything else. I pretended not to notice even that. I thought it better for them to think us unaware of their efforts. It might take us 3 minutes to make the necessary repairs. We can get away easily enough when we need to.
He finished cleaning himself, rose, and began to dress. He moved quickly and quietly, glancing over at the door every so often, listening to the silence that surrounded them. It was infectious, that silence. Everything about the druid's keep was measured in layers of silence, as if sound were an unwelcome intrusion. Perhaps it was, where power resided in such quantity, and struggles to control it were all done through secret machinations and subtle deceits.
I won't be sorry to be gone from here, she said. Everything about this place is oppressive. How your sister stands it is a mystery to me. I wish her well, once we have her safely back from wherever she's gone, but mostly, I wish her the wisdom to choose then to be somewhere else.
I know. He glanced around.
I wish I had a weapon.
She reached beneath her robes, brought out a long knife, and handed it to him.
I retrieved it from the ship. I have my throwing knives as well, but I don't think weapons are going to do us much good if we have to stand and fight.
They might against those gnome hunters. He tucked the long knife into his belt, then reached for the other druid robe.
Any sign of the young druid?
She shook her head.
Nothing.
They hadn't so much as caught a glimpse of him since he had slipped Beck the warning note on that first day. Beck had burned the note and had Rue scatter the ashes from one end of the keep to the other, but he still didn't know who had tried to warn them or why. Clearly, the young druid knew something about what was going on. He might know something about Penn as well, but it was too risky to try to find out who he was. The best they could do was to keep watch for him, and so far, he hadn't reappeared. You would think he would try to make further contact. Beck tightened the sash that bound the robe. If he went to the trouble to contact us in the first place, he must want to help. He must be on my sister's side in all this.
Maybe. But that doesn't mean he knows where she is or what's happened to her. He might not know anything other than what he's told us, that Shadea and the others are responsible. Maybe warning us was all he ever intended to do. It was enough to put us on guard.
Beck finished with his preparations and walked over to put his hands on her shoulders and draw her close.
You could wait for me aboard Swiftshore, he said. I can do this alone.
I think we had this discussion about 20 years ago, didn't we?
She leaned into him and kissed his mouth.
Let's just go.
They moved to the door and stood there for a moment, listening. The gnome hunters assigned to the task of keeping watch were still stationed across the hallway, but they had been there for 3 days, and they were bored. It wouldn't take much effort to get past them. Beck looked at his wife.
Ready?
She nodded, pulling up the hood to her cloak. He did the same, then opened the door and stepped through. Already he had the wish song's magic working, a soft, low hum that carried no farther than the ears of the guards. It whispered purposefully to form images in their minds. It told them that the cloaked figures leaving the room were druids, easily recognizable as such by their robes, that they needn't bother with them and could look away. By the time the guards looked back again, of course, the hallway was empty. Beck and Rue moved swiftly to the stairs leading up to the cold chamber, turning into the stairwell before they could be seen. They had been fortunate in not encountering a single druid on their way. If the gnome hunters at their sleeping room door didn't realize they'd been duped, they stood a good chance of reaching their destination unnoticed. They climbed the stone stairs to the next floor, sliding through shadows and pools of light as soundless and stealthy as foxes at hunt. This was a dangerous business, and they knew it. If they were discovered, their duplicity would be revealed, and there would no longer be any chance of using the druid's magic to find Pen. Worse, they probably